you are standing and expressing this is both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say black lives matter rather than all lives matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing educators and activists to campuses and communities across America to engage in meaningful dialogue about the pressing issues that confront our country and the world. If you enjoy the program, one way you can express your support is to become a monthly patron and sustainer of the show by signing up at www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. You can pledge as little as $2 a month or as much as you'd like, and not only know that you're supporting our efforts, but also gain access to bonus content, like premium commentaries on the events of the week, as well as signed books or DVDs. And all donations are tax deductible as they go directly to Speak Out to support their nonprofit activist mission. You can also make a one-time donation to the program at speakoutnow.org via PayPal, and make sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. I am your host. I want to start off by apologizing for my absence the last several weeks. As you know, we tried to move the show to a bi-weekly, sort of, you know, twice a month kind of program, and even then have been a little bit spotty in terms of getting episodes out. I want to apologize for that. Part of it was the whole Thanksgiving holiday thing. Had a friend in visiting, really wanted to just spend time doing family stuff, as I'm sure you can understand. So got a little behind. And have missed a couple of weeks in a row here, trying to get back on track even as we begin to move into the Christmas holiday stuff. A couple things that I want to address. Last week, a good friend and friend of the show, Mark Lamont Hill, who was on this program a couple months back, as one of my guests, was fired from his contributorship position at CNN. Because of some comments that he made last week at the United Nations Commission on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People. There was an event. He spoke at that event. Mark is someone who, among the issues he speaks about, and we didn't talk about this on the program when I had him on as a guest, but one of the things that Mark is very, very close to his heart is the issue of the Palestinian liberation struggle and freedom struggle. And he has been to Israel-Palestine many times. He has been working on a documentary, is my understanding. Also a book, I think, about the Palestinian struggle. And so he was giving a talk, and in that talk, he happened to, in addition to denouncing Israel's mistreatment of the Palestinians, both in Gaza and sort of in general, he used a very particular phrase at the very end of the speech, which created a firestorm. He called for a free Palestine, quote, from the river to the sea. And this set off all types of red flags for certain people and a firestorm of criticism. Ultimately, CNN removed him because of this. Temple University, where he is a tenured and endowed faculty chair, there are people on the board there trying to figure out how they can legally remove him for this comment, which is just a whole nother level of ridiculousness. It's a tenured professor. He has legal protections. The idea that he would be fired for this comment, especially from a public institution, I should point out, is especially egregious. just it'll be interesting to see where all the right-wing free speech warriors, the Milo Yiannopouloses and the Ben Shapiros of the world and the Dave Rubens and the Ann Coulters and all of these people that, you know, the Mike Cernoviches, the people who say that they're all for free speech when they think it's conservatives being censored just because people are protesting their speeches or don't want to pay them 10, 15 grand to come to their colleges and speak. We'll see what they do about the attack on Mark Lamont Hill at Temple University. But in any event, his comment about a free Palestine from the river to the sea created this firestorm because, according to some, that is a line that Hamas has used and therefore is a terrorist a slogan or whatever. Of course, the phrase from the river to the sea is also a phrase that Zionists have used to describe a unified Israel as a Jewish state. The land in between the river and the sea in this case is, depending on how you want to term it, Israel and or Palestine and or Israel slash Palestine. Israel has used that phraseology. Hamas has used that phraseology. Various other Palestinian groups have used that phraseology. And as Mark himself pointed out, after this controversy blew up, it's very similar, his usage of it, to the way in which we in the United States use that phrase from sea to shining sea. It's just all of the territory that we're talking about. It does not imply that, as some said, that he was talking about a free Palestine from the river to the sea, meaning the eradication of all the Jews on that land. He didn't say that. If you listen to the rest of his speech, or you look at the transcript of the speech, it's very obvious that he is talking about a piece of land where all should have equal rights, both Jew and non-Jew, Palestinian and Israeli Jew, all should have equal rights and peace and justice. He is not speaking of the elimination of Jewish people from that land. And yet that is what Ben Shapiro suggested in a series of tweets, that he was calling for the killing of Jews. Others said he was calling for the destruction of Israel. But I just want to point out the absurdity of this. You're talking about a network, in this case CNN, that regularly has guests on who flack for the president of the United States because they feel they have to have Trump people on. I get it. But these are people who are every day on that network advocating the gassing of children at the border, the separation of families at the border, tear gassing kids, building a wall, doing all kinds of horrific human rights violations, racist, xenophobic nonsense, people who get on there and defend the shooting of black folks by police virtually no matter the circumstances of the event, and they're allowed to remain in good standing. I should also point out that CNN and other media outlets and the larger American mediascape and political atmosphere and sort of political world have always allowed those in their midst who deny the rights of Palestinians entirely, who do not believe in the creation of a Palestinian state, who believe in the transfer of Palestinians out of Israel, not just Gaza and the West Bank, but Israel proper. Ben Shapiro, who doesn't appear on CNN, of course, very often, but someone who is a, you know, the sort of rising star in the conservative firmament, this is a guy who has openly advocated a few years back the forcible transfer, the expulsion of Palestinians from all of Israel. I mean, he at one point said that that was going to be the only solution. He has tweeted at other times that Arabs, you know, live in sewage while Jews and Israelis create advanced civilizations or something to that effect. You know, he's made horrific racist comments about Arabs, about Palestinians. He's made horrific comments about Muslims. He has called for the transfer and expulsion of non-Jews from Israel, and that's not apparently affecting his career. So why is it that you can deny the rights of Palestinians entirely? You can even deny that Palestinians are a people, as many of the most militant within the pro-Israel Zionist community do. They actually say that Palestinians aren't real. Golda Meir, the former premier of Israel at one point, said that, made that comment in the early 1970s, that the Palestinians weren't actually a people. I've actually seen Ben Shapiro put the term Palestinians in quotation marks or refer to them as so-called Palestinians. If you know the history of that argument, this position is that Palestinians are really Jordanians. They should all just go to Jordan. This, of course, is not true. It's not true historically. It's not true anthropologically. It's not true culturally. But it is something that many in the far right of the Zionist community believe. They believe in the forcible transfer of non-Jews from Israel. And so Mark Lamont Hill is against that. Mark Lamont Hill, like a lot of us, I think, who critique Israel, started out probably, I haven't talked to Mark about this, but my guess is that like most of us on the left who criticize Israel, we started out many, many years ago with a belief in a two-state solution, the importance of having a Palestinian state that would be independent Unfortunately, what has happened since then is that settlers have moved, with the encouragement, of course, and subsidy of the Israeli government, have come to Israel. Many of them, the most militant and right wing of Zionists in the world. These are folks who are either ultra religious and believe that they have a biblical claim on the land, or they may not be necessarily ultra religious, but they have this sort of incredibly right wing view of Zionism and the rights of the Jewish people to that land in its entirety, what they refer to as Eretz Yisrael, which is sort of the biblical land of Israel, Greater Israel, which includes land, which, by the way, biblically includes land that is part of other sovereign nations, including Syria and Egypt. So when they talk about Eretz Yisrael and they talk about the rights of Jews to the land that was promised them in the Bible, I should say promised us because I am Jewish, promised us in the Bible, they're really talking about a biblical claim on land that even Israel doesn't claim yet. So that's another aspect of some of the settlers' mentality in particular. Many of the settlers having a mentality very much like Meir Kahana, the founder of the Jewish Defense League, and then a far-right party for a while in Israel. He was actually a member of the Knesset for a while. He believed in the open expulsion, even extermination of Arab peoples. And so even though that's not necessarily the majority of Israeli opinion, there is an increasing segment of the Israeli Jewish community that does endorse that kind of thinking, and especially among settlers. So when you start out with a two-state concept, and then the settlers continue to build settlements, Israel continues to subsidize and help pay for that resettlement and relocation of Jews from all over the world. And now what has happened 30 years later is what many of us warned about in the 1980s and 90s, which is now Israel has, by virtue of pushing the settlement community into the West Bank, for instance, and taking more and more land from Palestinian peoples and what could have been a Palestinian state, have now created a reality on the ground that makes the two-state solution almost impossible, because the geographic location of that Palestinian state would be divided at various places. It would be choked off. Its access to water, its access to electricity, it'd be surrounded by hostile forces. Most of those who even ever endorsed the two-state solution always said it should be demilitarized. So apparently they believe Israel should be able to have weaponry and a military, but the Palestinian state should not, which is a whole nother issue about the hypocrisy of that and the hubris of that. But the point is that two-state solution is increasingly difficult to make happen because of the realities on the ground that Israel has created by virtue of pushing the notion of settlement. And so now we are in a situation where the only two possible options are an apartheid-like solution where non-Jews will always be treated as second-class citizens in terms of their access to land, their access to resources, their claim on the nation. And indeed, that is the case not only in the West Bank and Gaza, of course, but in Israel proper, where Jews have favored access to a number of amenities and resources, and non-Jews are treated indeed like second-class citizens. But the only other option is a one-state solution, binational, secular, and democratic, small d, where all Jew and non-Jew are treated equally. And for many, and I think Mark Lamont Hill's probably one of them, that's sort of what we've come to. Two-state solution might have worked 30 years ago, but now it really is increasingly untenable, and that's not the fault of Palestinians. It is the fault of the Netanyahu government and governments before Netanyahu, who allowed and encouraged such a dramatic rise in settlement activity that now the possibility of a viable, separate Palestinian state is almost completely unrealistic. So here we are. And Mark Lamont Hill, for calling for that binational secular state, which is really what he was saying when he says a free Palestine from the river to the sea, that's what he's saying. He's saying a nation that is free for all. But unfortunately, when folks hear that in the sort of militant pro-Israel and Zionist community, what they hear is the eradication of Israel. And in one sense, I guess they're right. It would mean the eradication of Israel as we know it, as the state of the Jewish people, by the Jewish people, and for the Jewish people. The fact is, we don't have a right to a state defined as ours and ours alone, where we let others live but not to have full and equal rights. We wouldn't accept that if Christians were to say that they wanted a state all to their own. We don't like it when Muslim fundamentalist nations essentially announce that these are Islamic republics and others have to leave. Jews have certainly been expelled historically from such nations in the region before, and it was wrong when they did it. It's wrong for us to create systems that are in any way similar. We wouldn't accept it, nor should we, if the white nationalist community community were to say, we want a nation with all whites, quote unquote, Aryans, and everyone else has to either leave or be treated as second-class citizens. So we can't have a standard for ourselves that is different from the standard we apply to others. And yet that's what I think people are arguing for. Mark Lamont Hill is calling for equity for all. He's calling for freedom and justice for all. And those who are attacking him are defending a system that elevates some above others. Now, you can argue with Mark Lamont Hill, you can argue with me and others about whether you believe a one-state, binational, democratic solution is possible. But whether you believe it is feasible or not, let's just be very clear. What we're doing now isn't feasible. That's what Mark's saying. It's not feasible for the Palestinians. It's not really feasible for Jews. I mean, the great irony of Israel is that the one place on earth where Jews are probably most at risk, and this is even in a world where we are seeing significant upticks in real anti-Semitism, not anti-Israel sentiment, but anti-Semitism against Jews as Jews in Europe, in the United States. We just had the synagogue massacre in Pittsburgh, the growth of neo-Nazi white supremacist activity in the U.S., which is pointing to Jews as the sort of principal, horrible, you know, group of people in the country. In the midst of all that, Israel is still the place where, from a physical perspective, Jews are probably most at risk. So the idea that this thing is working for anybody is arguable. And the fact that Mark Lamont Hill is trying to point that out vis-a-vis the Palestinians certainly should not cost him his job. There are some folks who have joined the chorus criticizing CNN for this, including Jewish Voice for Peace, which has condemned the action and called for his reinstatement. There is a petition calling for his reinstatement at CNN over at The Intercept. You can find that online. Probably several other petitions as well. So then the question is, what is this really about? And, you know, I was talking to a friend yesterday and she asked me this question. And I don't know if she asked it to me just because she thought I'm a smart guy and I know a lot, or whether she asked me because she knows I'm Jewish and therefore maybe I'll have some insight into this. And what I told her is, I think everyone has been focused on the phrase that Mark used, a free Palestine from the river to the sea, as the problem. I actually think that's not the phrase that triggered people the most. It's what they're going to point to, because they can try to link that to Hamas, I suppose. But I really think that it was his use of the term Palestine. What he did that I think offended so many is, you know, he referred to that land between the river and the sea as Palestine, not Israel. See, right now it's called Israel, right? That's the nation state terminology. He referred to it by a historic name and really sort of a political name, Palestine. He didn't even say Israel Palestine or Palestine Israel. He just said Palestine. And I think to a lot of pro-Israel folks, that is a linguistic erasure, right, of Israel. And so I can sort of understand if you heard it that way and you think, wait, he just erased Israel altogether, that you might then jump to the conclusion that he's saying all the Jews got to get out, right? If you don't listen to the full speech, if all you do is listen to the line, you could easily misinterpret it. Let me just sort of, not only in Mark's defense, but in general, sort of analyze this linguistic choice that he made, because I think, you know, if we're going to have conversations about difficult issues, we're going to need to understand one another's approach and terminology. You may not think that Mark's choice of words, for instance, were the best. I might not have said from the river to the sea, for instance, because of a likelihood of being misunderstood. And I generally, when I refer to that land, I do say Israel-Palestine or Palestine-Israel. But let me tell you, sometimes I will refer to that land also as Palestine, which is we're engaging in a bit of linguistic solidarity. It's symbolic. It does not mean that we believe that Jews should be expelled from the country. It doesn't even mean that we believe the future state as a binational, secular, democratic state necessarily has to be called Palestine. It can be called Israel-Palestine. It can be called something totally different. But for right now, we're referring it to it that way as an act of linguistic solidarity, the same way that sometimes you will hear people, not as often, but sometimes you will hear people, including non-indigenous North Americans, refer to the United States as what? Turtle Island. In solidarity with indigenous people for whom that terminology has resonance. Or you will sometimes hear folks on the left, for instance, who will refuse to refer to the United States as America for shorthand, because America is really a term that applies to an entire continent. And our argument sometimes when we do that is we say, look, the United States should not aggregate to itself the term America when that is a larger landmass. That's an act of linguistic solidarity. It's an ideological point, a philosophical point. It's largely symbolic. You might think it's silly, whatever. It's the same way, I'll give you an even more extreme example, but just to point out that people shouldn't get twisted up about this. Back in the 80s, those of us who were critical of United States foreign policy in Central America, the way that the Reagan administration was arming the Contras, for example, in Nicaragua, or supporting the government of El Salvador or Guatemala, those of us who opposed Reagan's policies in Central America had a very particular way of expressing linguistic solidarity with one side of that conflict, particularly as regards Nicaragua. And so if you were, as many of us were at the time, supportive of the Sandinista revolution and opposed to the arming of the Contras, when you would say the name of the country, Nicaragua, you would inevitably pronounce it Nicaragua. And of course, now that Nicaragua is the proper pronunciation in Spanish. So if you are a Spanish speaker, that is the way you would say it. But even those of us who are not Spanish speakers, those of us like myself who cannot speak a word of Spanish other than the little bit that I've learned from my kids who take it, we would just say that. I would be speaking to you, for instance, and I would say, we oppose U.S. foreign policy in Nicaragua. You knew that someone was pro-Sandinista if they pronounced it that way. If you were a committed leftist in favor of the Sandinistas, you absolutely said Nicaragua. And it was weird in a way. It was sort of silly, maybe, in a way, if you're not a Spanish speaker. It makes sense if you're a Spanish speaker. You know, we don't do that with other countries. Like my wife and I, you know, we had our honeymoon in Paris and we didn't come back and say, oh my God, France is so pretty in September. You know, we didn't do that. And so, you know, you might think it's a little silly, a little corny, but it certainly, you know, it was just a way of expressing linguistic solidarity. And I think the choice of the term Palestine by many of us who are critics of Israel is very much sort of the same thing. So I explained that to my friend when she said, what was all this about? And I said, the other thing that I think is important, and let me say, I have for a long time not spoken much about this. I've probably written 7 essays about Israel, and I've given a few speeches. I do talk about it when I'm asked. I get questions sometimes in in the Q&A sessions of my talks about it, and then I'll address it. And when I have waded in, one of the things that I have said for a long time is that although I understand the psychological connection to Israel, as a Jew in particular, I get it. I grew up hearing this stuff. I grew up exposed to the kind of narrative that can very easily lead Jews to this sort of hyper-Zionist space. So I get it. And I understand the source of it. And I think it's important to understand the source, because as critical as I am of Israel and as critical as I am of Zionism, I do understand that for many Jews, especially, only 75 years removed from the Holocaust, there is a fear associated with anti-Semitism that has not gone away. And it takes a long time for that kind of thing to dissipate. And look, when you have upticks in real anti-Semitism, like we're seeing right now in Europe and the U.S., desecration of Jewish cemeteries, this alt-right white supremacist movement that very clearly specifies Jews as quote-unquote the enemy, you know, you can see in the wake of that that there are real reasons for Jews to worry about anti-Semitism. I get why people have latched on in the American Jewish community in particular to Israel as this safe place, this place to which we could always escape if shit got really bad again. I understand it. But just because something made sense at a particular time in a particular historical context does not mean that that particular adaptation to oppression or that particular tendency or belief system is functional. I think that in the wake of World War II, I understand why many Jews would have felt that Israel was the solution, because they didn't feel safe in Europe and they weren't sure they could ever feel safe again anywhere that they did not control. I understand that. And of course, you'll notice that historically, Zionism did not really capture the imagination of world Jewry until after the Holocaust had happened. Yes, the Zionist movement had begun in the late 1800s, but when Theodor Herzl wrote The Jewish State and when those early Zionists began to settle in Palestine, it wasn't a movement that caught fire. Yeah, there were Jews that moved there, but I mean, they controlled a very small percentage of the land. And we're certainly not, it was not the kind of thing that caught on in a massive way in those early years. Those European immigrants, like my great-grandparents who came from Eastern Europe in the early part of the 1900s, for instance, they didn't really have any desire to go to Palestine. They didn't want that. They wanted to come to the United States. The United States was the land of opportunity. They didn't have any time for Palestine. They didn't want to go build a new nation. They wanted to come to the United States and take advantage of the opportunities that they felt existed for them here. And it was only really after the Holocaust and after the horrors of Hitlerism that, you know, Jews began understandably again to turn to this as a safe place. But I think that what has happened in the intervening years is that Israel has become a bit of a dialysis machine to a kidney patient. It's really no substitute for a healthy kidney, but it'll sort of keep you going. And I feel as though American Jewry in particular is in a very precarious place vis-a-vis an understanding of what it even means to be Jewish, and Israel has become a bit of a substitute. And what I mean by that, and this is why I think we're so bad about accepting criticism of Israel, you know, that if you think about the American Jewish community in particular, much more so, interestingly, than the Israeli Jewish community, where there is a lot of debate in Israel among Jews about the proper course of the Israeli state. There's a lot more criticism even of Zionism among people who are there living Zionism in Israel-Palestine than there is in the U.S., where there's more of a silencing culture around any kind of criticism. And the only reason that I can imagine that is true is that for most of us, and I know I can't speak for the broad swath of American Jewry, and I'm going to get hammered for saying this, but I think if we're being honest, we have to acknowledge, and now I'm talking about those of us who are Jews, that for the most part, Judaism in America is pretty secular. Yes, there are vibrant and thriving active Orthodox communities all around the United States, and there are certainly people in conservative synagogues and temples who are also religious, and there are people in Reform and even Reconstructionist temples and synagogues that are people of faith and who believe in God and who are spiritual or whatever else. But in terms of sort of a traditionalist perspective of Judaic religious teaching, I think it is fair to say that the American Jewish community is far more secular today than it was in the past, and relative to historic Judaism worldwide, far more secular, far less committed to living a particular set of laws as handed down by God. You will find a lot of secularism. Because Jewishness has been stripped to some extent of its religiosity in America, Zionism, political Zionism, and support for Israel, this sort of blind support for Israel, has become a bit of a substitute. So that the way that American Jews live our Judaism now, in many cases, is through this symbolic support for and connection with Israel. You know, we see their flag, it has the Star of David on it, that reminds us of our identity. It's a very powerful mimetic device. And if your Judaism is devoid of certain religiosity or historic connection to religiosity, how else do you live it? You know, is it just lox and bagels and cream cheese schmears? You know, what is it? Is you spend a dreidel certain times of the year? What is it? You eat matzah at Passover? Like, what do you, you know, what does it mean to a secular Jew to be a Jew? Now, for some of us, you know, we would argue that living a progressive and left politic of liberation is part of how we live our Judaism. My great-grandfather, when he came here from Russia, for instance, was a member of an organization, the Workman's Circle, which was a pro-unionist. It was a confederation of laborers. And like a lot of Jewish immigrants to the United States who were members of that organization or similar organizations, Judaism was about fighting for social justice. And that was part of how we lived our Judaism. But I think that we've sort of gotten away from that or understanding that, having a sense of that as being a Jewish thing. And so now a lot of American Jews have substituted support for Israel as the way that they live their Jewishness. And so when you critique Israel, that's why it seems like an assault on Jews. That's why people can say, well, you're being anti-Semitic, because two things have happened. Number one, we've replaced Israel for any other type of connection to Judaism in this country. And then secondly, Israel itself has done an excellent job of propagandizing world Jewry into believing that they are us and we are them, that they are our representative to the world, that they are our defenders, that we should identify with them, that they are our home. And so if you tell Jews that Zionism and Judaism are the same, two things happen. Jews will come to believe it. And then the second thing, the irony is, people who hate Jews will then decide it's the same thing, right? And so I realize, for instance, that a lot of the criticism of Zionism and Zionists as people does take place behind a veil of bad faith, that there are indeed folks who were simply Jew haters who use the issue of Zionism as a cover for that. Certainly when David Duke, for instance, criticizes Zionism, he's not doing it because he has some love for the Palestinian people. Are you kidding? Palestinian people are just a bunch of other brown non-Aryans about whom David Duke doesn't give a shit, right? Neo-Nazis don't love Arabs. Neo-Nazis certainly don't love Muslims. So when they criticize Zionists, it's because because they're it's a way to do it and not sound like a real asshole. They are doing it because they hate Jews. No question about it. When that guy goes into the synagogue in Pittsburgh and, you know, kills 11 people or whatever, he didn't do it out of solidarity with the Palestinian people, for God's sake. He did that because he hates Jews. So I realize that that has happened. That doesn't mean, however, that there can't be a legitimate criticism of Zionism as a political philosophy that isn't about that. But unfortunately, if you have yoked the notion of Zionism to the notion of Judaism and conflated the two, then not only will the Nazis think they're the same, but even many of us Jews will assume they are the same. And therefore, when anybody criticizes the practice of Zionism on the ground, whether it is Mark Lamont Hill or me, it will be viewed as an act of anti-Semitism, hostility towards Jews as Jews. Or in my case, or for those of us who were Jewish and criticized Israel, self-hate. And it just goes to show how little we're willing to have honest conversations about this really important subject. And I want us to have that conversation because it's important. It's important for the future and lives and freedom of Palestinian people. It's important for the future and lives and freedom of Jews as well. So let me just sort of talk a little bit about that. And I'm not going to litigate the history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for the last 70 years. I'm not going to get into all of the subject matter there. There are lots of people who do a far better job of that than I, and I will look to have some guests on to talk about that in future shows. But I just want to talk about this issue as a Jew and my concerns about the way that political Zionism plays out on the ground and limits our range of discussion in this country in a way that I think is incredibly unhealthy. And I have to start by saying that I've never really understood the lure. I do understand, as I said, why people have this connection to Israel. I just never felt it. And I grew up in Nashville, as I said, going to a Reform temple where it was certainly part of our, you know, curriculum. I mean, we learned about Israel. We learned a very limited history, a very uncritical, uber patriotic history, the same kind of history about Israel that many of us in this country learn about America. You know, it might as well have been the George Washington and the cherry tree version of the founding of Israel. No insights about the Palestinian perspective as far as I was taught, and I think this is true for most American Jews. There was basically no one there. I mean, that was essentially the settler narrative. The settler colonial narrative was that the Jews went and made flowers bloom in the desert in ways that no one had ever done before, as if no one lived there. It was just this vacant land, and we went and made it bear fruit. And this, of course, is a hagiographic, nonsensical, utterly ahistorical, just flat-out fraud, but it's what we were taught. And yet I never got it. There would be pictures, of Israel around on the walls in the temple, in the hallways at Hebrew school. And there would be plenty of books in the library. And every week we would take up tzedakah, which is a Hebrew word. Technically, it means justice, but it has been sort of, I think, interpreted as meaning charity. The tzedakah money, you know, you'd pull out a quarter or 50 cents or whatever, and you'd put it in the envelope you'd pass it around the room. And we were told that this was, sometimes it was being done for charitable projects there in Nashville. But a lot of times, you know, people just say that, oh, we're doing this so we can plant trees in Israel or something, or we're doing this, or, you know, this money's going to go toward some project in Israel. I never got it. I'll be perfectly honest. Maybe it was because I always felt like a bit of an outsider in the temple. I've talked about this many times before. My family, we were not professional Jews, quote unquote, but I don't mean professional Jews like you get paid for being Jewish. I mean, we weren't professional class status Jews. You know, we weren't doctors and lawyers and business people. And, you know, my dad was an actor and a stand-up comic, my mom isn't Jewish at all. My grandfather, my Jewish grandfather, was a small shop owner. You know, so, I mean, it was sort of, we didn't really have the class status, the economic status of most of the kids that I went to Hebrew school with. We were sort of, you know, for lack of a better way to put it, the broke-ass Jews in the temple. So I always felt a bit like an outsider. I was also one of only a handful that went to public school. So I never quite fit in. And I was also, you know, by nature, a bit of a contrarian. And so if everyone else was going to be, you know, militantly pro Israel, I was probably going to be the one who dissented because that was just sort of my, maybe in my character. But as I grew up, I started to really sense that in this country, we weren't willing to have an honest conversation about these issues. And for some people, maybe they're just noticing it now with what has happened to Mark Lamont Hill. But, you know, many of us have been thinking about and talking about this for an awful long time. Back when I was in college, I went to Tulane in New Orleans, and Tulane has a pretty sizable Jewish population. I didn't know that when I went, and that's not why I went. I actually went to Tulane because I was chasing a Catholic girl who I was dating at the time who was going to go to LSU. I didn't even know there were that many Jews at Tulane, interestingly. But when I got there, it was a very vibrant Jewish community. And the rabbi at Hillel at the time, who I became friends with during the time that I was there, had been a big supporter of the anti-apartheid organization. So we were pushing for divestment from South Africa. He was a big supporter. Hillel had been a supporter, had signed on in favor of divestment from South Africa. And one day before the end of my senior year, we had built a shantytown outside the administration building. We were on hunger strike. I think it was around the same time. This particular Hillel director, the rabbi at that time, Harley Kars Wagman, and he came up to me and he said something about, he thanked me. He said, "I think it's really great that you all have done all of this and you haven't dragged Israel into it." And I didn't really know where this was coming from. I wasn't sure why he said this, but what he was referring to, I came to understand, was that a lot of the criticism of apartheid at that time, and it was criticism that I was certainly aware of, was that Israel had been supporting the military, the South African Defense Forces. They'd been engaged in joint training exercises with the SADF, the IDF and the SADF. They had provided certain technology transfers, weapons, money, support that was helping to bolster the apartheid state. And what Harley was saying at the time, the guy at Hillel at Tulane, was thank you for not bringing that up. And I thought it was weird because the only reason I hadn't brought it up, it wasn't like, you know, I had said as a Jew, oh, we're not going to go there, or that we'd even had a conversation about it. We weren't focused on that because as Americans, we were focused on American support, U.S. support. And as Tulane students, we were focused on Tulane support. I wasn't avoiding bringing Israel into it for any particular reason other than it just didn't seem particularly relevant. Over the summer, I graduated from Tulane, went home to Nashville, and came across an article over the summer written by this right-wing, ultra-reactionary Zionist named Bertram Korn, who I think might also be a rabbi. And he was at that time the head of a group called the Committee for Accuracy on Middle East Reporting, or CAMERA. And it was this, you know, ultra-racist, anti-Arab, anti-Palestinian organization. And this particular piece, he was defending Israel's support for South African apartheid, basically by making the argument, well, you know, South Africa also gets support from the Arab states. So if they can do it, we can do it. And, you know, why shouldn't we do it if they're doing it? Which is sort of the, you know, defense you used when you were seven and you broke a window playing baseball and your mom was going to punish you. And your defense was, well, Billy was playing too, sort of not the point, right? But that was Bertram Korn's argument. It's about that level. It's a second grade level argumentation. It just pissed me off beyond belief. So I went back to New Orleans. I was working with a underground newspaper that I'd been involved with at Tulane called The Avant. And I wrote a piece for The Avant called Breaking the Silence. And this piece was me finally breaking my silence as an American Jew criticizing Israel briefly for its treatment of the Palestinians, but mostly in that particular piece because of its support for South Africa. And I thought it was relevant and I thought it was important. And I explained why. And I was responding specifically to Bertram Korn. So after the article comes out, and I should point out, this is well before the advent of the internet, right? There's no internet. So when you had something to say back in that day, you know, you printed it up. We had a print shop that we used over at Loyola University at the Toomey Center, Peace and Justice Center, connected to this Jesuit school right next door to Tulane. We used their print shop. We print up like 300 copies of this thing, and we put them out, you know, at various points around the campus. 300 copies, maybe 400. So nobody is seeing this thing, but the rabbi did see it. And so Rabbi Harley Kars Wagman loses his mind and calls up the house where we were living. I say we, meaning the people who were putting out The Avant. It was sort of a press collective, a co-op of sorts. It's really just a big, nasty, haunted house, but we tried to make it sound political. And he calls up, he speaks to one of my roommates at the time, Shiloh DeWeese, and goes off on Shiloh about this article. Screaming and yelling. She's not even able to get a word in edgewise is what I hear from her. I'm actually at that time out at my girlfriend's house at the time, her mom, who lived outside of New Orleans. And we're just hanging out having dinner. I get a call. Again, no cell phones. Just get a call at the house from Shiloh, who says, oh, we just got this call from Harley, and he's really furious about your article. So we start talking. I asked Shiloh, I said, well, was there anything in the piece that was wrong? Because again, what I was doing was laying out the bill of particulars about Israel's support for South African apartheid and all different stuff and why it concerned me. One of the reasons that I was so angry about it was, if you know the history, you know that like six of the first seven, I think it was, heads of state in the apartheid South African state had actually been locked up during World War II for collaboration with the Nazis. These were people who had been open Nazi sympathizers. So I found it a bit ironic and troubling as a Jew that people who had been open Nazi sympathizers would now be getting support from Israel. Call me crazy. I thought that was a pretty decent argument. Anyway, Rabbi Harley apparently did not. Goes off on Shiloh. I asked Shiloh, well, did he tell you I got anything wrong? Because God knows, if I got something wrong, we'll print a retraction. If I got something wrong, I'll make a correction. I don't want to be incorrect in my analysis. And she said, oh, no, he didn't say you got anything wrong. It's just that he shouldn't have said it. And he goes on to say, according to her, the direct line was that Jews should not air other Jews' dirty laundry. And that was the moment, I think, when it first crystallized for me that we are a society that is unwilling to have these conversations, in part because those of us who were Jews are so psychologically wedded to Israel in a post-Holocaust world, in part because the United States as a country has relied so much on Israel as a forward deployment base, both directly and indirectly, literally and metaphorically in the Middle East, that you just can't criticize them because they're such a great quote-unquote ally. Christians don't want you to criticize Israel because they have this biblical connection. I'm talking specifically fundamentalist and evangelical Christians, right, who always talk about how much they love Israel. But you dig deep enough, you realize the reason they quote-unquote love Israel is they want all the Jews to go back there so that it can usher in the second coming of Christ, at which time, of course, all the Jews who haven't converted will be sent to a lake of fire. So thanks, no thanks, right? So nobody wants to have this honest conversation. And any criticism of Israel, even if it comes from a place that is pro-Jewish, my criticism of Israel's support for South Africa was a pro-Jewish critique. My argument was, how dare this state that claims to speak for us support a country whose leaders historically had been collaborators with the Nazis? How anti-Jewish is that? But you can't say that. And so I got attacked. And the rabbi at Tulane calls up the Louisiana Coalition Against Racism and Nazism, which was the organization that I began to work for doing the anti-David Duke work. And they try to get me fired from the anti-Duke job because of this article. Again, criticized Israel for supporting racist, criticized Israel for supporting Nazi collaborators, in effect. Therefore, I must be punished and removed from my job fighting an actual Nazi running for office in the state of Louisiana. I mean, how ironic is that? And anti-Semitism, if we understand that as hatred of Jews, as Jews, that's what that is. Criticizing Israel is not hating Jews as Jews unless you accept upfront the idea that the Jews and Israel are the same. And the only people that ever said that is Israel itself. The only people who said that is the Zionist movement. That's not a historic thousands of years old understanding of Judaism. That is a modern contrivance, the idea that to be Jewish is to automatically defend the settlement of Jews on this particular piece of land. It's absurd. But the fact that we view criticism of that as inherently anti-Semitic is only possible because we've decided that Judaism and Zionism are one and the same, when they're just simply not. After that experience at Tulane with the anti-apartheid article, in 2001, I wrote a piece that was released right before 9/11 happened. It was a piece about, I'd finally decided I wanted to put something out criticizing Zionism itself as a philosophy, criticizing some of its origins, explaining why I thought it was not a healthy political philosophy, not only for Palestinians, whom it has resulted in their oppression, but even for Jews, that I thought it was unhealthy. And I talked a little bit about the history of it, about the way that Herzl and others in the early Zionist camp had really, in my opinion, and obviously people can disagree with this, but if you go back and you read some of that early Zionist writing, I found it to be incredibly self-hating. Herzl would say things, you know, basically rationalize anti-Semitism. At one point in his writing, he talks about how, you know, it's understandable for people to hate us because wherever we go, we either rise and we have the terrible power of the purse, which plays into every possible stereotype about Jews as, you know, economically manipulative, or we sink to the level of the peasantry, and then, you know, that causes people to revile us as well. Therefore, it's understandable that they hate us. And if you read Zionist early writing, they're making it very clear to them, they believe anti-Semitism is an inevitable state, that there's no way that you can ever get Gentiles not to hate us. And not necessarily because Gentiles are horrible people who are inherently bigoted, but because we're inherently hateable. Go read some of that early Zionist writing. It is contemptible for what it says about Jews. And it was our own people saying them. I mean, that's how incredibly pathetic it was. And so I wrote this piece criticizing the philosophical underpinnings of Zionism as something that was not only bad for non-Jews, but also bad for Jews. And again, the knives came out rhetorically, and I was attacked for that. And then in 2003, the Jewish Federation of Des Moines, Iowa, decided to uninvite me from an event, an MLK Day event that I had been invited to, because the head of the Jewish Federation there at the time, a guy named Mark Finkelstein, had come upon some of my writing, decided that it was anti-Semitic, of course. One of the arguments they made, very disingenuous, but very typical of these folks, was that how dare they invite this man who criticizes Israel to an MLK Day event, because MLK himself was a supporter of Israel, and he himself said that criticism of Zionism was nothing but anti-Semitism. Turns out that this quote that the Jewish Federation in Des Moines was using, it was a completely fabricated quote. It doesn't exist. The source, the footnote for this particular quote, I looked it up. It doesn't exist. Dr. King never said this, but it was an example of the dishonesty to which defenders of Israel will go to shut down any type of criticism of Israel. Later on that year, actually it was the next year, I think 04, I went and gave a speech at Swarthmore. I was invited in by a Jewish organization that was anti-occupation, against the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, and went and gave a talk where I made these arguments again, and I made them with full understanding that yes, some critics of Zionism are absolutely hiding behind that as an excuse for their Jew hatred, but there is a legitimate Jewish argument against Zionism. And it was historically an argument that plenty of Jews made for the first, you know, 30 to 40 years of the 20th century. But now you just don't hear it anymore. And I tried to lay this out, and the reaction from the Jewish kids at Swarthmore, it was a mostly Jewish audience, and some were very supportive and others were having an emotional meltdown. I mean, people were crying because they felt as though I was besmirching the history of Jews who died in the Holocaust. It was like this emotional, again, a dialysis machine that was keeping them healthy, and to have anyone question it was a step too far. So what's happening with Mark Lamont Hill, and I know this has been a long sort of discussion, but what's happening with him is part and parcel of a longstanding tradition of shutting down any legitimate criticism of Israel. And I'm here to tell you, the more that you do that, the more you endanger everyone. You don't just endanger Palestinians, you endanger Jews, because when we come across as a people that are not willing to brook any criticism, and when we come across as a people who stand against exclusive nationalism when white racists do it, we stand against Islamic states that are exclusive and treat non-Muslims as second-class citizens. We certainly would not support the notion of America or any other nation as a Christian republic. If we're going to take stands against those other forms of exclusivity, religious, cultural, ethnic, or quote-unquote racial, then for us to then say, yeah, but we're different because of Hitler, we're different because of the Holocaust, it's different with us, is disingenuous. People who say that criticizing Israel's anti-Semitic because you're singling us out among all nations on earth, you're singling out Israel, they're full of shit. That's not true at all. Those of us on the left who criticize Israel and want, you know, divestment from or boycotts against or sanctions against Israel, we say the same thing about Saudi Arabia. We say the same thing about South Africa back in the day. We believe in sanctioning and divesting from countries with shitty human rights records, but especially when the United States is implicated. There are lots of countries on the earth that have worse human rights records than any given country that you might be criticizing at a particular time. There's no way probably objectively to say this is the worst and here's number 7 and here's number 14. But if you're an American citizen, it makes sense, doesn't it, that your primary concern is going to be those countries that the United States helps to prop up. So in my opinion, I think, you know, you look for my money, that is Israel and that is Saudi Arabia. Those are the countries that I think we're heavily implicated in economically, militarily, in terms of sharing intelligence and all these other things. So I think it makes sense to critique them. Just as during the Cold War, those of us on the left spent more time criticizing the United States and our orbit of influence and our allies than we did the Soviet Empire. Not because the Soviet Empire was any less horrific, and it wasn't because we believed that our side was more evil, it was because it was our side, right? So if you're an American and the United States is a principal supporter of Israel, then it makes sense that you would focus on that and not necessarily Iran, right? Which has a shitty human rights record, but we're not propping that up in the same way. We're not supporting that in the same way. The same would have been true during the days of the Soviet Union. There were plenty of nations in the Eastern Bloc that were horribly oppressive, but it would have been absurd for us to say, well, let's talk about Romania, you know, as much as we talk about El Salvador, or let's talk about East Germany the way that we talk about Chile. It just doesn't make sense. It's not because Chile was worse than East Germany. It's not because El Salvador was necessarily worse than Romania. It's just that you have to use your influence where you can. And so for America, that means criticizing Israel. For those of us who are Jews, we have a special obligation, I think, to be critical of Israel. After all, they say they speak for us. And if you're a Jew who doesn't want Israel to speak for you or thinks that the speaking they are doing is contrary to your values, then you have an obligation to speak up, not only because that's right for the Palestinian people, but that's better for Jews. You know, it's funny, historically, and, you know, those of us who are Jewish know this, the way that Jews used to come to politics historically in this country, and maybe some still do, was we would always ask the question, what, you know, is it good for the Jews, right? Because when you're a marginalized people, that's what you do. You think like a marginalized people, and that's understandable. You think as a group because you know shit could go south like any minute, right? So it totally makes sense. But the problem is, I don't think we ask that question anymore about Zionism. Is it really good for the Jews? Are Jews actually less hated today because of Zionism? Are we less hunted today because of Zionism? And I would argue the answer is no. I'm not suggesting, please do not misunderstand me, that the reason for anti-Semitism is Zionism, that somehow, you know, that we've brought it on ourselves. That's not my argument. Anti-Semitism has existed for a very, very long time, for thousands of years. And even in the absence of Zionism as a political movement, it would exist. But what I'm saying is that it certainly has not helped. And if you have a world in which this hatred of Jews for cultural reasons, for religious reasons, etc., has been a long-standing phenomena, the last thing you want to do, it seems to me, is create an exclusivist mentality that says we have rights above others, we should be privileged above others, we should be able to treat others the way that we do not want to be treated. It seems to me, in a world of anti-Semitism, you do not lay that philosophy on top of that world and then act surprised when it comes back at you. This is not healthy for anyone. Which is what I think Mark Lamont Hill would say, and I want to have him back on the show and give him the chance to say that if that's his viewpoint, or to clarify what his viewpoints are. But we've got to get to a place where we can engage this conversation honestly. And I say that as an American, I say that as a Jew, I say that as a human being who cares about the well-being of everyone in Palestine, in Israel-Palestine, whichever terminology you prefer. Maybe. Just maybe we can have an honest discussion without censorship, without charges of self-hate, without charges of anti-Semitism as to what justice is going to require. And if we don't start opening up to that conversation, the future of Palestinians, the future of Jews, the future potentially of the entire world is going to be considerably more grim even than it is today. And that'll do it for another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Please join me again in 2 weeks for the next episode of the show. And in the meantime, you can check out my articles at medium.com, as well as my website, www.timwise.org. And follow the show on Facebook at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Instagram. Take care and join us again in 2 weeks. In the flames, roll higher in the